This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Brooke Warner. She's the publisher of She Writes Press. And this is a second visit to Publishing Talks after, I think, 10 years since we did the first one. So it's good to see you, Brooke.
Thank you, David. I know, a whole decade. I can't believe it.
Time flies.
It really does. That is always true.
It is odd to think about. Well, as you get older, time, the way you think about time changes, and it goes by quicker and quicker. So 10 years doesn't seem like that long. So what I wanted to talk to you about today, aside from just, you know, it's always fun to talk about books with people in the publishing business, is to talk about hybrid publishing has evolved over the last 10 or 15 years. We've both been involved in it for some time, and you've been writing about it in your Substack newsletter, Writerly Things, which I read regularly. And the last one you wrote about 10 days ago was a kind of update on the state of hybrid publishing. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about some of the issues that you see at the forefront right now as they've emerged over the last number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what inspired that post was really a couple of different things. You know, one is that I am actually being approached by traditional publishers who are interested in starting hybrid arms of their business because they're scared about their own margins and worried about the future of the book business and trying to find sustainable ways to stay doing what they're doing. And for a lot of people, that traditional model that has always worked, or the numbers have always worked, all of a sudden things are feeling a little bit more precarious. And that's having to do with just competition, you know, on eyeballs. And it's more books, obviously, but it's also podcasts and courses, online courses. I mean, there's just so much content that it's really eating into publishers' book margins. And then the other thing, of course, is that there's been a lot of layoffs in big publishing. And so you are seeing traditional, like people who have been in the traditional space, starting hybrid companies. And so that was the other thing that I wanted to address, because some of them are starting hybrid companies and either insisting it's not hybrid or I guess I would also say, you know, coming into the space and acting like they invented it when it's been around for a long, 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 long time. And so I get a little reactive to that. And sometimes I'll use my platform to, you know, reestablish a baseline.
Well, it is true. There are a couple of things there that I respond to, because I also have noticed people proclaiming that they're inventing this new form of publishing.
Yes.
And they give it, they've created language around it to obfuscate or perhaps make it sound different and better and more exciting and somehow new and different, you know, partnership and, you know, working together to create a different author-centric model. You know, there are all,
right,
all these terms
yeah,
that basically maybe mask the kind of underlying structure that we recognize and don't disagree with, you know, and
exactly.
Have no
complaints. I think that's the point. Like I'm an advocate of this model, and I'm very interested in emerging models and that people might be doing something differently, but this space is, you know, very full of smart people. And so I think if you arrive and proclaim that, you know, you're the new kid on, not even the new kid on the block, the new inventor of everything, you know, the god of the space, then the people who have been there for a little while, of course, we react to that.
Right. It might have something to say about it, but it's also, we welcome those new kids on the block. We welcome
yes.
them to the party. But it's all, and I think you've been part of this, you know, in the evolution of what's now called hybrid publishing, because at one point, I would say 10 or 15 years ago, when there wasn't a term that was identifiable. It's, you know, it's emerged as a term, I think, beneficially. Previously, it would have been called author subsidized or creator subsidized
or co-publishing. You know, I think co-publishing and partnership publishing are other terms for it. And I've been advocating for that label hybrid because I think it adequately and accurately describes what it is. But what, of course, has happened over the years is that hybrid has been co-opted by people who are not, in fact, doing hybrid. Really, they're just doing assisted self-publishing models, in some cases, even predatory models. And so I've watched with some degree of apprehension slash horror, depending on who the person is, you know, when they're calling themselves hybrid. And then in fact, they're not really offering authors a good service. And so it is a very muddied landscape and people are constantly jockeying, you know, to either align themselves or not align themselves, which for even in the publishing world can get a little confusing. But I certainly understand that then if you're an author, you're looking around just trying to make sense of it. And how could you?
Well, and I think from our perspective as publishers, you know, we want it, we want clarity and fairness to be first and foremost. You know, you want to be able to say, here is the business model. This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
This is how it works. And hybrid publishing may not be for every author, but there are a lot of authors who are confused, I would say, about what it will, it looks one way up front and it's going to look different down the road. And I think it's, you know, behooves publishers to be 100% transparent. And one of the things you also talked about, which I think is part of a lot of the conversations I have with not only authors, but I'm sure you have these conversations too with content owners who may not be literally individual authors. It could be a corporation or a nonprofit. There are a lot of entities that want to publish books and will be participant in the process with a publisher because their desires are not necessarily commercial. I mean, it's actually my aunt did this for years. She worked for the Whitney Museum and they published art books that were subsidized. And that's like 40, 50 years ago, subsidized by a gallery or subsidized by a foundation because no one could make those commercial ventures. They just are not going to work.
Well, but it's an important tangent because I think sometimes people will love to use the term vanity, you know, as a cudgel of some sort. And yet what you're talking about is exactly that. Like there are absolutely instances and historically and now where beautiful books have always been subsidized for any number of reasons. And sometimes because the author themselves is entrepreneurial. So obviously when you subsidize some portion of your own work, then you're going to get a higher royalty. And what nobody is talking about is some of the predatory practices of traditional publishers, you know, who are retaining IP for no reason other than they just can, you know, who won't sell the content back to the authors. And even if they're like at zero sales, you know, so I find this whole conversation, you know, one that I have defended for a long time, but it is really important when you're looking out at the broader landscape to say, this has been going on, this kind of co-publishing, partnership publishing for a really long time. And things just kind of ebb and flow and things come in and out of fashion. But I've been staunchly advocating for this hybrid model now for 15 years because it works, you know, and it makes sense to my authors who opt into it because most of them are getting passed over by certainly the big five simply because they don't have an author platform. You know, it's like it's almost a non-starter. So they're not even looking at the content. They're not looking at the books. And then what is an author to do? And so I think we're just in an interesting moment where, you know, it's much more embraced on the one hand, the author subsidized model. And on the other hand, there's a lot of people in the space nitpicking at what we all think it should be called.
And maybe it does, in a way, it doesn't matter.
Right, exactly.
What it should be called. And you can look at the kind of a spectrum for an author or an entity from self-publishing where you hire all of the services and learn how to be a publisher and do it all yourself with assistance. I mean, it's most people who self-publish end up hiring people to do a lot of the things that we do or that publishers do, because that's, you have to do that in order for the book to look like a book.
Right.
But I compare it to building a house. I mean, some people have the skill set to build their own house. They know how to do it. They've learned the mechanical skills. You know, they can carpenter. They know how plumbers work, and they can hire an electrician to come in. You know, do all the things they can do, and then hire the things they can't. But with hybrid publishing, it's more like hiring a general contractor, because you say,
right,
I really don't want to learn how to build a house. You know, maybe I'm 50, 60, 70 years old. It's a little late for me to gain the skills to become a carpenter and contract for my own house. So I'll hire a hybrid publisher to do all of that for me. And then, you know, traditional publishing is like you buy a house that's already built.
Yeah.
And, you know, you pay the profit for all of that to the builder.
Yeah, I like this, David. I've heard so many analogies over the years, and I've never heard that one. So, well done.
I'll take credit for it. I've used it for a long time, because when you say to someone, think of me as a contractor, a home building contractor, they kind of get that. You know, most people, whether you've built a house or not, or, you know, maybe you've renovated or something, it's fairly similar. Reprinting a book that's already been published is kind of like renovating a wing of your house. So
I love it. Yeah, it's great. I might use it in submissions conversations.
You are so welcome.
Acquisitions, yes.
But I think that using that analogy, I think people have, you know, there are people who mislead consumers, mm-hmm. who don't tell them the full story, and then there's surprises down the road. And I think that one of the things I think you worked on, because you were in IBPA and you kind of worked toward having this idea of a legitimization and of hybrid publishing, almost the way that, and I thought of this as, you know, the organization of literary agents, they have self-interest in creating a set of standards that they can say, I am a member of this organization. I am a legitimate practitioner of my art, and I will follow ethical practices. And I think maybe it's time for hybrid publishers to have a trade organization of their own, for the same reason. Not because I don't think we have the same commercial interest that a true trade organization would have, but just for self-protection, because you, I think you kind of hit on that at one point as a really big issue. You mentioned it today, that there are people that are not to be trusted, and we want to be able to say, here's a trustworthy entity.
Right.
Not just because I say I'm trustworthy, but because I follow a set of practices.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously what we were attempting to do with the IBPA's hybrid criteria checklist. And that's now been around since, I think, 2018, if I'm recalling correctly. And it's an interesting question, because I think as a hybrid publisher, of course, I'm a member of the Independent Book Publishers Association, and now PubWest has merged with the Independent Book Publishers Association. So now we have this one primary organization, and then there's IPC, you know, the Independent Publishers Caucus. So it would be, I think there's a question of how much advocacy and support an organization like IBPA gives hybrids, which I think it really has done a great job. You know, I continue to be very involved, and it's always a question of, you know, do we need something new, or do we just need to carve out a better space, you know, in an organization that's already doing good work?
Well, that's true. And there's overhead in any organization that needs a lot of work for everybody involved, usually. And I think probably, as I think about it, maybe IBPA is the best home for some kind of effort like that. But I think it would be good for publishers to be able to say, you know, we are members of IBPA and we adhere to these principles. And if you're not a member, you still can be a hybrid publisher, but, you know, we can't guarantee that they're following the same practices.
Yeah. And it's always been a challenge. You know, this is one of the challenges when we started that hybrid criteria checklist, was that at that time, IBPA said, you know, we don't want to police our members. And I completely understand that. So it does put the onus on authors to do their research, to feel good about the people that they're partnering with to ask the right questions. So I will put a plug in for any author who might be listening to look at that criteria. And if somebody is a hybrid publisher or an aspiring hybrid publisher, also to look at it and say, am I meeting these measures? What does this look like? But, you know, obviously, if you're an advocate of transparency, if you're an advocate of, you know, doing right by your authors, you're already going to be inclined to be that way, you know, and the people who are doing predatory practices, they're kind of operating from a shady baseline. And so it's a challenging space that we're in. And all I can do, I find like that my role is really around author education. And that's what I try to do with my Substack and a lot of the work that I do, you know, not trying to tell publishers what to do.
Well, that made me also think about, I think it's called Author Beware.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think has done a really good job also of keeping track of potential scams. A lot of the authors that I work with are getting emails constantly from who knows who saying, you know, we'd like to represent you to Hollywood, or here's a marketing program that you can hire. You know, I'll right. get you 100 reviews on Amazon. You know, all these services. And they constantly are asking me, and I'm sure you see this too, like, is this something I should be doing? And sometimes I look at that, it can't be real, but how, you know, it's really hard to know.
It's really hard. Yeah. And they're targeting people who want to hear good news, you know? And so it's an extra, extra challenging space right now. I mean, I get stuff from my authors all the time.
Well, and this goes to one of the things you talked about earlier and in your piece the other day, that is the sheer number of books published, which is partly because of the ease of the process now. You know, it's become truly democratized, not right. only, and of course, abused as well. But it's the way I look at it is, I don't think the number of books read has increased massively over time. I think mm-hmm. the number of books read overall, or the number of books sold, is relatively stable, but the number of titles published has expanded
right.
unbelievably. You know, I'm older than you, so I can look back to when I first started publishing books, late 1970s, 38,000 books a year being published with new ISBNs. No such thing as ebooks and audiobooks right. were almost inconsequential. Those were all either hardcovers or paperbacks. So under 40,000 new titles a year. And now we don't really know, and it's really hard to count. I see the 4 million number, mm-hmm. but then I think, oh, ebooks, you know, they're counting ISBNs, and the same sure. title might have two or three ISBNs. So I kind of think, I always think 1.5 million, 1.8 million individual new titles published each year, maybe 2 million.
Right.
Somewhere, but it doesn't matter whether it's 2 million or 4 million. It's like a crazy number of books. And as you mentioned, unbelievable numbers of products that can take your time and immerse you in reading experiences. I think reading yeah. online is underestimated. I think people read a lot of content, newsletters, websites. We're just consuming content constantly. So books have trouble competing. Mm-hmm. You know, any book you publish is in an environment now where the number of readers hasn't increased and people don't have as much, you know, there's a lot of free options too for your time, or seemingly free because you're paying for subscriptions that you forget that you're paying for. And then people look at a book and they think, well, I'm not going to buy that book because it's $20 and maybe I won't read it. And so this goes to, in a long roundabout way, a question about also all those kind of scam emails that we all get about marketing. The really big challenge now is not publishing. The really big challenge now is figuring out how do you find readers and how do readers find you.
Well, and maybe that's been the challenge for a while, for sure. Yeah.
No, it's always been true. I think it's just more. The reason that you're hearing from traditional publishers is that it's beginning to affect them in more than marginal ways, that they are experiencing, because I'm sure you look at BookScan all the time, as right. I do. I see what the unit sales are for many commercially published books are not high enough for a sustainable business.
Right.
Because I know what things cost, and you do too. You know, if you sell, if you're investing, if you're a publisher investing in publishing a book and you sell 1,000 copies, it's not a commercially viable
right.
operation. So I think this is where the challenge is for hybrid publishers, along with every other publisher. And I don't know whether anybody has answers for authors who wonder, you know, how is this going to work for me? How do I sell books?
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think we're in a real inflection point here because of the number of people in the space. I mean, maybe more published books than readers. People joke, and it's obviously not funny, but you know, it's like, I agree with you. And I think it's a real challenge to the industry. I mean, one of the things that is true is that people, of course, still want to be published authors very badly. And so, and being an author matters in our culture. And there's a big book culture, right? I mean, even just book talk on TikTok, or I mean, I don't know how big Bookstagram is at this point, but still there's a big book culture, right? Like people love books and love to talk about books, but probably don't read that many. I probably listen to more audiobooks than I read books these days, simply because the time that I can fit that in is in the car on my walks, you know? And so I'm very grateful for audiobooks. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of an existential crisis, and then not to mention AI. And so I think we're in a big swirl right now where publishers are really just trying to figure out, can we make a go of this? Can we sustain it? And I do think this is going to just result in a major influx of traditional publishers doing hybrid. I just can see the writing on the wall.
Well, the two things I think about that. One is, it's possible that things will ebb and flow. You know, you sort of believe in the idea of a dialectic, that demand and supply do have relationships. And right now we have an overabundance of supply, and demand is not flexible. Mm-hmm. So what ends up eventually happening is people who thought that they would sell a lot of books don't, and maybe they opt out of doing the next book, or maybe it becomes, maybe there is some reduction in output. I don't think that will happen anytime soon. I don't think it's quite that easy or flexible, because people don't always publish for commercial reasons. They often publish out of desire, out of the need of, as you said, it's a book culture. We want to be published.
Right.
We want people to read our stuff, but you have to publish it first. But the other part I thought about that is, new ideas will emerge, you know, or it always happens that, you know, their publishing is fairly conservative, but people are thinking about ways of finding readers. You know, it's going to be a necessity. And I guess what I'm hopeful of is that there will be some, you know, new methods. I don't want to say new ideas, but new things will emerge, maybe via technology. Maybe you can use AI creatively as a tool to find a book, or as an author, as a tool to help you find readers in ways that have not yet emerged.
Right.
Because AI, somebody, I think I read this yesterday or maybe today, somebody called AI a weird technology. It's like, and I like that. You know, it's like, really, anybody who says they know what it is probably full of shit. It's something strange. We haven't seen it before. And maybe we're right to be afraid of it. Maybe we're right to be critical of it. I don't disagree with people who oppose it out of hand. I think that's fine. But I think that it is weird. It's not like anything else we've seen. One thing I don't like about it is it's owned and controlled by a small number of really big companies, which I think is always bad. But technology right. like this tends to escape into the wild, you know, that people figure out ways of using it, sometimes for ill, but sometimes for good. So I don't know. I mean, it could be total lunacy on my part to think this way, but you know, I want to be an author that I talked to once about, and I explained that I want to tell the whole story, right? That how, what the challenges are. I don't want an author to come in thinking bestseller, you know, I am a good writer. This is a great book. Why shouldn't it be a bestseller? So you always have to tenor your expectations with some reality. And then you feel like you're throwing cold water on somebody's dreams.
Right.
And the response back saying, don't tell me all the things that are the no's. Tell me, okay, given all of the difficulties, tell me creative things that I can do that will, you know, you just have a chance. So you don't always want to be, you don't want to be a pessimist out the door. You want to be a realist, but then you still have to find a way of creating positivity.
Yes, I think that's an important component of doing the work that we do. I mean, it's easy to get cynical, but I think to stay in it, ultimately, you have to be an optimist. I like what you're saying about AI being weird. I mean, I'm distressed by it because I think that people can't help themselves. You know, I think one of the challenges of it is that once people start using it, they can't not use it because it's like this mental crutch in a sense, you know, and I've just seen that with people that I know. I mean, I've made a very clear intention that I won't use it in my own writing because of that, because I think it leads to a certain amount of laziness. And I don't even judge people. It just makes sense, right? But because I'm using it for other things, you know, I'm using it for research and I'm, you know, trying all kinds of stuff just to see what it can do, but drawing a hard line at my writing. And we're seeing it in our submissions, you know, we're seeing it all over the place. And so it's just another aspect of the whole sort of disruption of our industry that we don't even know the ways that it's going to impact us, of course. I mean, these next 10 years is going to be quite a ride.
I mean, this is a question, I think, for every publisher, hybrid or otherwise. Are there ways you could use AI in your process that would reduce the cost of publishing and increase the efficiency so that it would be, let's say, less expensive to publish a book, but still do it well? You know, I worry about that because I think the first thing people think of is, oh, this is a way of getting rid of the people that do the job. I feel really strongly that publishing is a craft. I'm an Eric Gill supporter, you know, that what we do is a craft and there's a human element to that that's not replaceable by machinery. Now, I know that's not true. I think a lot of what we can do is replaced by machinery, and we're all using, you know, Microsoft Word and InDesign, which 30 years ago didn't exist, and publishing books was a lot more time consuming before these tools came along. So I think kind of similarly, can AI be used as a tool in ways similar to the way InDesign and Word, and, you know, maybe it will make it easier for an indexer to do her work? Will it make it quicker for a proofreader and improve the work of a copy editor? Those are questions that I have. Mm-hmm. Now, have fewer copy editors and proofreaders, not that you would replace them with machine tools, but that they would be able to enhance their work.
I mean, the jury is out on that. Like, we have a very hard line on not using AI for design and editing, in part because of exactly what you're saying. Like, we value the humans behind this and we don't want to replace our processes with AI, especially when I myself am, you know, have basically an anti-AI stance when it comes to writing, you know, and so therefore with the production of the books as well, like, I don't think it's fair to say to authors, don't use AI. And then we're like, oh, but here's our AI generated cover, our AI generated interior. And then, you know, I think it is really scary right now for these people who are worried that their jobs are going to be replaced. And I feel that too, you know, and so certainly for the time being, I'm holding that line, but I do worry that there will be a slippery slope in every single industry, you know, when it's like you can't beat your competition because the competition is, you know, has AI designing their interiors. You know, what are we going to do if people are saying, oh, well, I'm going to your competitor because it's X amount cheaper, but the reason they can do that is because of their margins. And it's concerning. We're not there yet. So I can only say what we're doing right now and how we're reacting to AI and what we're trying to make our policies be. But I very much think this is an existential crisis, you know, around human labor and human creativity.
I think that you're right. And I think that we're at this, you know, it is an inflection point, but it's very early on and we don't really understand what's going to happen. But it's, I think you can, one element that we can see is in the production of books, that there are a lot of AI created books that as products that are taking up space. I mean, I do think that there is a negative effect that we can see right now. And that is if you go looking for books and you can't tell the difference between an AI generated piece of junk, because you, and especially since most people shop online, you can't see the book. You can't tell from its online view that it's a piece of junk created by AI without any real human involvement. Those books will distract readers from other books that we would want them to find.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be, you know, there's the guy I interviewed a while ago, Derek Newton, Verify My Book. You know, he's able to use technology to tell you the percentage of human writing in a piece or the percentage of AI in a piece of writing. And I think that if I had any influence over Amazon, which I don't, I would want them to start verifying the content of the books and say back to publishers, you have to prove that this is a human created book in order to have a sticker on it that says not made by robots.
Well, the challenge there, though, is I'm sure you've heard, is a lot of these technologies have false positives. And so, like, there's a big amount of concern going on that they're not doing a good job of necessarily identifying, and people have been putting their own writing that is human created into these machines and then getting feedback like it's X percent AI generated. And it's really challenging, of course, because AI is also like getting better and better, you know, like training on human writing. And yeah. So now the new thing is like, oh, okay, well, is there going to be like witch hunts in publishing where people are being persecuted, you know, and accused of writing with AI or using AI when in fact they're not. And so it's just opening up a whole new, I don't know, moral conundrum, I guess, around the expectations. And I'm sure you heard like Hachette canceled that book, Shy Girl, recently. Many people have now since come to her defense and feel that Hachette was hasty. And so I just am watching this stuff being like, oh my gosh, all the things that we couldn't have predicted. And AI allows us to be morally superior, you know, and also encourages lying. And I mean, I think it's just brings up so much moral complexity. I don't know what we're going to do.
And yeah. As a practical basis, I think this would be true for independent publishers of all kinds, hybrid or otherwise. When people come to you with a manuscript, and you don't know, are you asking whether it's they've used AI in writing the book? Because I think now you have to do that. Then the question is to you as a hybrid publisher, going into partnership with an author, you have to decide then how much of, let's supposing they say 97% is written by me, but I used AI to clean it up.
Right.
Are you okay with that?
Well, people are saying that in our submissions, you know, they're using language like, AI did an editorial cleanup, or I used AI as a thought partner, or, I mean, like some people are very comfortable admitting the capacity in which AI helped them because they just have a different kind of relationship. I've actually talked to some of my authors about toning down how they talk about AI because you're entering into an industry that has a very fraught relationship with it. And so I don't want my authors to be naive and be, you know, talking to a bookstore or talking to a librarian or being on a podcast and sort of, you know, being very nonchalant about landmines. And so I'm not trying to tell people to lie, but I am trying to coach and just be like, this rhetoric is very complicated. And I am annoyed sometimes. Like one of the reasons this came up was because somebody was prepping for a podcast and she wrote me, I think she sent me 10 questions and she said, my AI assistant created these questions for you. And I thought to myself, so AI is interviewing me? Like, it was surreal. And I found myself looking at the questions and feeling like this woman didn't do any research. She was just sort of like, here's what AI thinks about you and here are the questions. And it impacted the way that I thought about the interview.
Yeah, I can see, I hadn't thought of that, but yes, that seems, I instantly started thinking, wow, you know, when I do my interview, my podcast with authors, I read the book and then I think about it and I write, I want to ask questions about the book. It never occurred to me, but I can see that people would do that to get help with those questions. Or maybe next thing you know, somebody will ingest the entire book into AI and then have AI ask all the, compose the questions and right. They could interview the author. Why would you need a human?
And then there's all this speculation about how much the AI hallucinates, like if you were to feed something into it, is it even accurate? I mean, I think that will change over time, but at this point, I would never allow AI to assess a manuscript. I just think that's ridiculous because, like, depending on the machine, like the ChatGPT is completely sycophantic, so it'd be like, this is the most brilliant piece of writing I've ever read, and like they're all very different. And they're also, we have to imagine like who is creating these models and on what standards, they're just tech bros as far as I can see. And so like, they don't have like literary taste or don't really know like what's fresh and new. And so I think there's a lot of people saying like, oh, well, AI has all this capacity and maybe it does, but I can't imagine making editorial decisions on an AI model. That's like not in my near future. And I hope it's in my never future.
Well, we'll come back in another few years.
Yeah,
we'll
exactly. In 10 years. And we'll be like, oh man, AI is doing everything.
I don't think it'll be 10 years. I think it will be accelerating. So I'll be back to you in 2 years.
And okay. We'll see
by then what has
come
of us if we are still extant.
If we're still employed.
Yeah, right. Well, okay. So before we go, what do you think is the most interesting thing in publishing today that you would just, as a something to think about and talk about, what really grabs your interest right now?
Oh my gosh.
I know, those kind of questions are terrible, but...
It's really good. I mean, I think the things, because it obviously depends on like who you're talking to, how they're going to answer. And like, I watch the industry, but I'm less of like a trend follower and more of an advocacy person, so I'm always looking at these points of advocacy. And so because we've been talking about AI, the main point of advocacy that I see that like there is a vacuum that somebody needs to step into is creating some kinds of regulations or just set of guidelines that publishers can turn to say, this is what we collectively agree. And it doesn't mean that every publisher is going to sign on. I mean, it reminds me much of the hybrid criteria checklist that we were talking about earlier, but I know a lot of people who have really taken the bull by the horns. And they're like, we have AI language all over our website and these are our policies. And other people who just have their head in the sand and are like, oh, well, we're just pretending it doesn't exist. And I think it's a really important conversation and that publishers are used to just being sort of far flung and on their own, which is why I love IBPA and connecting with other publishers. But if we want to survive what is coming, we actually do need to band together and talk more to one another. And so there's a little bit of strength in numbers and just trying to figure this out. And that's what I'm interested in at the moment. I don't think it's the most important thing in publishing, but for me personally, that's kind of on my radar as something I would like either the IBPA or IPC to take on. And in terms of trends, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk about, you know, just all these books and AI slop and all the rest. I mean, I agree with you. I would love to see some of these platforms have stronger criteria about what they will and won't publish, you know, just some really like basic baselines, but they won't. You know, I mean, we're talking about Jeff Bezos here, and no, they're not incentivized.
Nope, I'm afraid that's true. It's going to be up to us,
yeah,
not the greater them.
Yeah.
I think from the consumer side or from the production side, not from the platform side.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been great.
Thank you, David. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. And I hope that as things evolve, you will too. And I'll keep following your blog. I'm sorry, your newsletter. I shouldn't call it a blog, but it's almost like
it is. I mean, it's a newsletter blog, so that's okay. I like the language. We'll keep it alive.
It's good. So this has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Brooke Warner of She Writes Press. Thank you once again.